The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Our next guest has written the book Upheaval: How Nations Cope with Crisis and Change. He is the acclaimed author Jared Diamond. Thank you very much for being with us today. Your new book looks at the experiences of certain countries to crises, not quite existential crises, but very, very significant ones. But you also look at the global phenomenon of climate change. And I'm interested in how you think politics and nation states are going to adapt to climate change. We've had our own European Parliament elections here in recent days. We're seeing something of an uptick in support for the green movement. But is this something that you think is going to be an international phenomenon given the crisis facing us?
It is an international phenomenon. And in fact, the next last chapter of my book, Upheaval, after discussing national crises, discusses crises facing the whole world. Climate change is one, but there are several others. There's also the nuclear risk. There is the non-sustainable exploitation of necessary resources, water, forest, fish, and there's inequality around the world. So those are world problems. But as you say, nations have a framework for dealing with national problems. The world seems to be lacking a framework, but it turns out that there is a track record of the world in the last 50 years about dealing with world problems, and that's why I'm cautiously optimistic.
Okay, well, the nuclear thing is something that I think people pay little attention to anymore. The existential crisis from the time of the Cold War is largely disregarded by many people. I'm not going to get into that. I do want to talk to you about the environmental issues, though, and climate change, because there does seem to be an attitude amongst a lot of governments is that this is somebody else's problem. We're only a small contributor to the overall. What's the point in us doing anything if the real problems are in the United States, China, India? Why should small countries like Ireland harm their standard of living to accommodate other countries?
Because Ireland is part of the European Union, which is one of the four biggest exploiters of resources in the world. Yes, you're a small country, just as California is a small state. But Ireland is disproportionately important in the European Union on the one hand. And on the other hand, if these things get messed up, Ireland is going to suffer the consequences of it.
But then what about individuals, persuading them that they may actually have to have a noticeably inferior quality of living to actually live to the standards required to deal with climate change?
That's interesting, and it's wrong, and that's a common belief in the United States. Often one hears Dick Cheney and Bush Sr. said, the American way of life is non-negotiable. The idea was that we Americans were going to have to lower our standard of living. Nonsense. Much American consumption is wasteful. American consumption of petrol per person per year is double that in the European Union. And it's not that we get ourselves a higher standard of living as a result. It's that we have gas-guzzling cars. So the fact is that we could reduce our consumption rates without sacrificing standard of living.
Well, let me give you another example. Lots of Irish people like getting off this island to see the world, to travel on a regular basis to other countries. To do so, they use airlines, aircraft. Those are gas guzzlers as well, aren't they? There's a massive environmental impact, which people say they want to live a cleaner life until it actually impacts on their enjoyment of life.
That's right. One has to figure out if you're going to burn petrol, which ways of burning petrol are justified and which are not justified. I would say that driving a Humvee is not justified. And I would say that traveling around the world for me and for many Americans who will inform themselves about the world is justified because the United States is such a big player. Most Americans are so ignorant of geography, and it behooves us to learn more about geography.
Yeah, but is that not about having your cake and eating it? Because it suits you to go and do certain things that you can sort of justify your environmental behavior.
If by going around the world we learn and we clean up our environmental behavior, then that's money for jet fuel well spent.
The issue of climate change, though, doesn't seem to be getting sufficient attention amongst some governments, particularly the Trump administration in the United States. But is it possible that businesses will end up leading the way, that businesses reacting to the desires of consumers will make the changes that in time will have to be followed by governments?
Yes, and that's a big change in the U.S. in the last 10 or 20 years, not widely appreciated. It's one of the things that gives me most hope that we will, that the world will solve its problems. I'm on the board of directors of World Wildlife Fund U.S., affiliated with yours, and I've also been on the board of directors of Conservation International. So I see what's going on in big businesses. On our boards are the ex-CEO of Coca-Cola and a CEO of Walmart and of Unilever and Chevron. So I've been involved with big companies. It's true that these big international businesses, some of them do terrible things, but it's also true that within the last decade, they've learned that it's to their advantage to operate more cleanly. As a banal example, Walmart has the second largest fleet of trucks in the United States. It spends an awful lot of money for truck fuel, and it realized that if it could triple the gas efficiency of its trucks, it would save two-thirds of its gas bill. So there are advantages to business, and businesses recently have been learning that it's good for them in the short run and the long run.
Yeah, but that example you give strikes me as not something that they're doing for environmental reasons or ethical reasons, but it's quite simply a cost-saving initiative that perhaps the only way to change behaviors is to make it more profitable for people to do so.
You're right about that. So part of the motives, big businesses have multiple motives for doing environmentally clean things. Some are narrowly economic, as in the case of Walmart's trucks. But there's also a good deal of idealism behind it, and there's also employee retainment. Companies like Chevron, big fossil fuel companies that send their employees overseas. These employees are well-trained, they're educated, they care about environmental matters. It's important for Chevron to be able to retain employees. You may again say, well, that's self-interest. All right. Whatever it takes to get them to adopt good policies, I'm in favor of. But I've also seen a surprising, to me, amount of idealism among the CEOs of Chevron and among the CEOs of Walmart, doing things because it's the right thing to do.
Your background is fascinating. As well as being a professor of geography at the University of California in Los Angeles, you're also an historian, you have an anthropologist, you've had an involvement in biology and ornithology. A fantastic range of things. And your book deals with things like the Soviet invasion of Finland, the forced opening of Japan to international trade, coup in Chile in 1973, Germany's self-examination in the aftermath of World War II. That in particular is fascinating to me because even in recent days with the whole Brexit thing that's going on in Britain, there's a whole range of British people saying, well, we beat them in two world wars, we'll beat them again. I mean, Germany's role in the European Union, how significant is, do you think, is it in its desire to maintain and keep peace in Europe, which is often forgotten by the likes of the British?
Dominant. After all, what, 10 million Germans got killed in World War II? Far more Germans got killed in World War II than British. And of those who were not killed, another 10 million became refugees or were raped, and others lost their education. Germans have suffered in enormous numbers from the impacts of war, and the result is that some age cohorts in Germany, they're strongly pacifist. So in the 1950s, when the precursors of the European Union were starting to form, a goal announced then, I lived in Germany in 1961, was that Germans and French and Belgians wanted a gun whose barrel was made in France and whose trigger was made in Germany and whose bullets were made in Belgium and with the result that it would now be impossible for there to be another war in Europe.
And yet the British still are obsessed, or some elements of the older British people obsessed with not being defeated by Germany as part of the European Union, war by another means. There's one final thing I want to bring up with you. You say that nations sometimes follow people in the use of crisis therapy along the steps, acknowledging the crisis, accepting responsibility, getting help, and honest self-appraisal. Now, your book doesn't cover Ireland, but it strikes me that when we had our financial crisis about a decade ago, we acknowledged the crisis. We did, to a degree, accept responsibility for our own problems. We got help from the IMF and from the European Union. But we went back. Our political system, instead of actually looking to use the crisis to create something new and different, effectively tried to go back to where we were beforehand, to re-establish all the things we had. Why would we have done that, in your view, as an outsider, do you think? And how successful is that likely to be?
Well, of course, this reminds me of Britain, the UK, where I lived, where why on earth, after joining the European Union, would they go back and now be considering getting out of the European Union? Countries like people are imperfect. They react to crises in constructive ways, but not completely in constructive ways, and they may revert. A couple that has marital difficulties and gets through their marital difficulties, does that mean that they will never again have marital difficulties? No. And similarly, Ireland, having gotten through the financial crisis, does that mean that your financial management will be perfect for the indefinitely foreseeable future? No. Ireland is a normal country.
But the point of not trying to look to create a new way of doing things, so almost to try and bring us back to where we were before things fell apart. Is that a logical way of dealing with a crisis?
It's not a logical, constructive way, but nations, just as people, are often not logical and constructive. Britain being another good example of that.
Well, we know that only too well at present. Jared Diamond, the author of Upheaval, How Nations Cope with Crisis and Change. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.